My name is Steve Huey. I've met many of you. I think there are a few new people, but I guess you'll be introduced tonight. We're glad that you're all here. I'm going to be talking to you about La Fe y Esperanza en Medio del Sufrimiento, and my talk isn't going to be in Spanish unless you would like for me to do that. But before I started today, one of you said to me, "Say, I think I know what that word medio means." They said, "You know, somebody told me that if you think it looks like an English word, it probably is the same word." So he said, "That probably means médico, or doctor." And I said, "No, that's not quite right." And that reminded me of when I first started speaking Spanish. Actually, I wasn't speaking Spanish very well, but when I was studying Spanish to work in Venezuela, at my first sermon, which was entirely too soon for my abilities, after I had started studying Spanish, I was so afraid and frightened about this experience that I actually had to sit on a chair. I couldn't even stand to give this sermon. So I thought it would be informal, you know, and maybe they would notice my knees were knocking so bad. And so I start out my very first sentence with this congregation, and I said the following. I tried to do the same thing this fellow did. I thought, well, if you don't know the word, you just think up a word that sounds like it should be, right? So I said, "Estoy embarazado por estar con ustedes," or something like that. And I had just said to those people that I'm pregnant. So of course, everybody cracked up. They were really amazed at what they had before them, I'm sure. But one good thing happened as a result of this, and that was that we had fantastic attendance at church for the next 5 or 6 weeks. They wanted to hear what crazy things this gringo would be saying. So. That's right. Well, seriously, one real good thing that happened was that I was forced, because of my poor Spanish at that point, to work together with my members and preparing a sermon that would really speak to their needs. And this is something that I've found helpful even today in my work in English, to have someone else sit down with you and think about what are the needs of the parish. What should we say to the people based on this text for this week? And so sometimes the Lord can use your weaknesses and even your foolishness to do some good things, I guess. Seriously, though, I would like to talk to you about this subject. And to help give you a clue as to the meaning of these Spanish words, I'd like to read from 1 Peter 1, verses 3 to 7. "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his great mercy has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to obtain an inheritance which is imperishable and undefiled and will not fade away, reserved in heaven for you, who are protected by the power of God through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials, that the proof of your faith being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ." Did that give you any kind of a hint as to what these words may mean? Well, these words that we just read speak about faith and hope, and that's what these words mean, faith and hope in the midst of suffering. We're referring to the Lutheran Church and Christians in general in Central America who are growing in faith and hope as a result of their suffering and their difficulties. It's a strange thing, isn't it, how sometimes the Lord can use very bad situations and turn them into good situations. Use very bad situations and make us people of God who understand better our task and our calling to be his people. The story I want to share with you is a story of faith and hope in the midst of terrible suffering in El Salvador, on the basis of some contacts that I have with fellow Christians there. I'd like to give credit to several people, a friend by the name of Bob Huebner, another friend by the name of Bob Gussick, and another missionary by the name of Gary McClure. All three of these men have worked in Latin America, and some of them are still working there and have recently visited the people that I'm going to be talking about. So it's really based on interviews with them, my own experiences in Latin America, reading, and some correspondence with the people there that I'm sharing what I'm going to share with you. This story needs to be told because I think it has something to share with us. So often we think, when we think of other countries like Latin America and Central America, we think about what we are giving or should be giving or doing for Latin Americans. And I believe this story tells us something that we need to be aware of, and that is that they have a great deal to share with us, that we have a lot more growing to do. Maybe because of their circumstances, they have a lesson to teach us. I've put a little outline up here for you, and this is what I hope to follow to keep a little order to this. The abduction of Pastor Gomez and Dr. Ibarra, the reasons for their abduction, the response of the church near and far, effects on Gomez's life and the life of the church in Central America, and then finally some key questions which are raised by this abduction and some of the circumstances surrounding it. Well, the abduction itself, what was this all about? On April 27, 1983, Pastor Medardo Gomez, who was the pastor and is the pastor of the Lutheran Church in San Salvador, El Salvador, and also director of the Faith and Hope Refugee Center, and his friend and co-worker, Dr. Angel Ibarra, who was a medical doctor and is a medical doctor, were coming out of a meeting that was being held at the Faith and Hope Refugee Center, which was run by the church there. It was about 10 o'clock at night. They'd been meeting for some hours with a group of Scandinavian refugee workers who were there to help them and consult with them about how they might be more helpful to them in the future. As they were going toward their car, some witnesses from the church saw them being abducted and thrown into the back seat of a car, and the car sped away, and they could only imagine what was going to happen. This was the typical thing that would happen when the death squad hit someone or took someone captive. So immediately the church began to respond to this, and I'll explain a little more about how they responded in a moment. But to continue with the abduction, what happened was Pastor Gomez, who's also president of the Lutheran Church in El Salvador and now is president of CONCAP, which is the Association of Lutheran Churches in Central America, was taken along with Dr. Ibarra to a place that they are still not able to describe because they were blindfolded. And they were interrogated separately, and Dr. Ibarra was beaten, and Pastor Gomez was questioned but was not beaten. After a period of a day had gone by, they realized that something unusual was taking place because no one lived beyond 24 hours when they were taken by the death squad. That was pretty common knowledge. So they knew that something strange was happening or something out of the ordinary. They could only assume that something had occurred to put pressure on the people who had taken them. They had no idea what this was, but of course they were living in tremendous anxiety, wondering if they would be killed, why the delay, what was happening, and so forth. To make a long story short, Dr. Ibarra was held for 6 months. He was taken to a different prison after a certain period of time and was held there and was questioned repeatedly and beaten at several different times. Pastor Gomez, on the other hand, was released after 3 days, which was very unusual and an extremely unusual circumstance that he was left after 3 days. So these are the facts regarding the kidnapping or abduction. And now the reasons for the abduction, I think, are important. And these have all been put together by the people involved, Pastor Gomez, Ibarra, as they've shared this with the missionaries that I told you about earlier. One of the reasons for the abduction, the reasons that they feel, at least, has to do with their discussions that same night with the Scandinavian relief workers. The feeling on their part was that because the Scandinavians had and still have diplomatic relations with Cuba, there was a feeling on the part of the government in El Salvador that perhaps they were in collusion with some kind of element that might be trying to overthrow the government. And it turns out that the Scandinavians had just come from Cuba, and so this gave further weight to that possible argument that they might be agents or in some way trying to overthrow the government. Now that shows you how paranoid the government might be. But this is a theory, and I have to stress that, but it's a very good one. Another reason, or possible reason, for the abduction is that Dr. Ibarra had helped some of the opposition guerrilleros in a village that the Lutheran Church has work in. These men had been brought in on stretchers. They were bleeding. They were hurt badly. And so the doctor did what any doctor would do under those circumstances. He helped them, and he tried to heal their bodies. But this was a very bad thing from the government's point of view for him to do, because it showed that he was in league with them, that he sympathized with them, and so forth. This is not such a theory. I think this is a definite reason, because Ibarra himself was told that this was why he was taken at certain points in his captivity. A third reason why the abduction took place perhaps had to do with the fact that Pastor Gomez, in his work as a pastor, had on numerous occasions helped people who had relatives who were working with the guerrilleros, or who themselves had come in contact with the guerrilleros, because it's almost impossible in some of the small villages where the guerrilleros come in to get supplies and even have family members not to know these people and to work with them. It's a difficult thing to just say, I'm not going to talk to these people, if you see what I mean. So Gomez also had some guilt, in quotes, as far as the government was concerned. So these are three possible reasons for the abduction. Now, what was the response of the church to this situation? The first response was an around-the-clock prayer vigil. As I mentioned earlier, one or several of the people saw the abduction, so they knew immediately what had taken place, and so immediately the people went back into the church and continued their service and continued to pray and call people from home who had gone home, and they prayed for 24 hours and continued it into the next days until Pastor Gomez was released. Then the other response was the prayers and letters from Christians and other congregations all around the country, and particularly from other countries. In the U.S., in Scandinavia, of course, the Scandinavians who had met with these people also shared the news immediately. They got to their wire service, and almost immediately this news was all over the world. The Lutheran World Federation became involved, the Lutheran Council in New York. And through the Lutheran Council, the news was shared with President Bowman of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. His church is the church that's related to this particular church in El Salvador. And this is an interesting response that I'd like to share at this point. President Ralph Bowman of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, by chance, was in Washington at the very moment that he received the news about this abduction. This was the next day. He also, by chance, was in the office of Ed Meese, who was a Lutheran, as some of you might know. And it was a little bit difficult, as I hear it, for Meese to just ignore this situation. And so, as we have learned in the meantime, Ed Meese discusses with other administrative officials, and they discussed it in turn with the U.S. ambassador in El Salvador. And he put pressure on the government, saying that these men should not be killed. Now, this is a story that probably none of you have heard, because it's not been made public. And later I want to talk to you about why I think that has not been made public. It's an interesting point. But it's one of the responses to this abduction. And then finally, the response of the fellow Christians in El Salvador was very heartwarming and special. Christians from the Roman Catholic churches, from the Pentecostal churches, all kinds of people shared their concern and their love for these people, and did things that showed they were willing to risk their own lives and reputations to side with these people. So those are some of the responses of the church, both near and far, to that problem. Now, what have been the results of all of this, or effects on the life of Medardo Gomez particularly, and on the life of the church? This is a part, I think, that has a lot to say to us. Well, first of all, we should acknowledge that there were some negative results. Pastor Gomez tells his friends, including the men I talked to you about before, that his wife still almost becomes hysterical if he returns home a half hour late or 15 minutes late from a meeting, because she just imagines that he's been picked up again. And you can sympathize with that. You can think, how would I feel, you know, if this had happened, and would I do it any differently? So that's one of the negative results, that some of the people live in fear that this could happen again, especially those close family members in the situation. But the positive results or effects have been far greater, and they're really tremendous. And this is the part that I think we can learn from. In this way, we could say that this event, this abduction, that's why I place so much emphasis on it, has been a kind of catalyst to help the church focus on itself, its ministry, and what God is calling it to do. One of the results is that the answered prayers of the people in the church have given everyone a renewed hope in this sense. They can see that God is still in control after all. In a situation which seems hopeless sometimes, where it seems it's out of control and that no one is in control, it gave them a sense of hope that God could still intervene and still bring about a result that would be different from the normal. And the normal is almost always death if a death squad picks you up. Another result was the feeling of unity with fellow Christians, as the church there realized, perhaps for the first time in this particular circumstance, was so dramatic, how much other Christians around the world cared about what was happening. Can you see how that would be? And then another result is for Pastor Gomez himself, and I think this is the most dramatic part of the story. What I'm going to say now may sound a little disparaging, but it's part of the story, and I think he would want me to share this because he shared it himself just this way, and I can really believe it because it's exactly the kind of thing that we faced in our mission work with our fellow workers and national workers particularly. But the feeling that we had as missionaries and working with our national workers, because of the structure under which we all had to work, was that many of our national workers were not working with their full heart in everything they were doing. They were working as employees, so to speak. It was a very bad situation from my point of view. And this was still the situation before the abduction, even though there were fewer missionaries at this time in El Salvador than perhaps in an earlier period. So Pastor Gomez tells the story that he himself realized when he came this close to death what ministry really was all about. He saw his whole life flash before his face, and he said to himself, how have I really ministered? Have I done it with my heart? Or have I done it, you know, from a job, just to do a job? As a result of this experience, he says, I learned that I need not fear anything, even death. And that I could go back and I could work without being concerned about what the mission board thinks anymore. or without being concerned about what some other group of people might think if I talk to these other Lutherans or this other group of people. He was able to deal with some real concerns in his own personal life that he had never dealt with before. And I guess only someone who's come that close to death can really experience what he experienced and tell what he told. I guess it's like Dan was trying to tell us in the Bible studies this week. He was able to see that he had been eating out of the wrong feed boxes all along. And that now he could go to that feed box and get the food and nourishment that he needed. And that he could face anything that would happen. As a result of seeing Gomez go right back into the refugee camp and with renewed faith and vigor begin his ministry again, other people in his church could sense the change over just immediately, and they were able to grow. It was almost an automatic overnight renewal in the church. The church began to see its opportunities. Before, no one would think of becoming an evangelist or a pastor unless he had his salary assured. But now all of a sudden the church began to see the opportunities they had for ministry. They had refugees coming into the camp all the time. They were serving more people than they could really handle, 800 to 1,000 at a time. And many of these people had relatives back in villages, and they wanted to have someone go back to those villages and share what they were learning in the daily worship in the camp. And who was going to do this? And so then, one by one, different people became aware of their responsibilities. People who had before just sat at the feet of the pastor began to say, what can we do? And without any training that was, let's say, on a real deep level, seminary training anyway, with some real concern for the people, understanding that they knew more already than many people who didn't have any help at all, as many as 11 men at the time, I heard the story, and I've heard now that it's up to about 20, have become deacons, and the church has even ordained these people to go out into the villages and to share their faith with people in these places. That's a neat story, I think, and it shows that people are able to give and to share their faith, even though the government might consider them an enemy for doing that. Even though they might not get paid for doing it even. And then another result has been that these people in the Lutheran Church have begun to see themselves as partners with fellow Lutherans, something that they had not been able to understand and appreciate before. As I said, I think the feeling was that they were recipients of all the goodies that we send, and yet now they begin to see themselves as partners. Becoming vulnerable, as was said earlier this week too, was part of the secret. Becoming vulnerable for the first time, they realized they had power. And the most important power there that they ever could have, that was the spiritual power to share their faith with others. And then a final result would be that faith and hope, fe y esperanza, continues with even more commitment, with more involvement of the lay people and the church itself in El Salvador. There needs to be, of course, more and more of these kinds of centers for people to come to, refugee centers, because there are so many people without a place to go. You might be interested to know that in nearby Honduras, there are many, many people from El Salvador trying to find refuge. But since there are as many as 100,000 campesinos, or poor farmers, in Honduras who do not have land, this puts tremendous pressure on them not to welcome with open arms these new arrivals from El Salvador. So where do they go? What do they do? And while their villages are destroyed, or while their crops have been wiped out after they've worked so hard because of the battles that are taking place around them. These are some of the things that they're facing. Well, we get finally to the unanswered questions, and this is exactly where I wanted to be right now, about 4:30, so I'd like for you to help now a little bit as we talk about these questions. And what I'd like to do is read the questions to you that I have thought of, and then ask you to choose the ones that you would like to talk about, and we'll do it in order as long as we can, as long as you want to. One of the questions that all of this raises in my mind is, why should it be wrong in any culture or circumstance for a Christian physician to treat or help anyone, including the enemy? Well, what would you do in a similar circumstance? Why is the U.S. supporting a regime which over the years has permitted numerous human rights violations such as the death squads? Can the administration justify a policy of seeking a military solution in El Salvador? Do you think that things will change at all under Napoleon Duarte? What can we as citizens of the United States do to help our fellow Christians in El Salvador in their quest for justice and peace? What can we do as Christians? Then question 3. Why is the story about the administration's role in saving Ibarra and Gomez not publicly known? Is there any connection between the answer to this question and the fact that Dr. Ibarra ended up seeking asylum in Canada rather than the United States? What could the fact that the United States' pressure on the military government of El Salvador at the time of the abduction of Gomez and Ibarra possibly show about the government's connection with the death squads? That's an interesting question. Number 5, what really saved Gomez and Ibarra? Prayer? The letters from other countries? The pressure from other countries? The pressure from the United States administration, as I described it? Or a combination of the above? Have we as Christians, number 6, have we as Christians really prayed for our fellow Christians in Central America? Do we pray specifically? Do we pray regularly? Why or why not? Why do we often wait till there is a real crisis before we pray? Or why do we pray only when we know the person personally? Number 7, if you had been a member of the Gomez or Ibarra families, how would you have dealt with your own apprehension, fear, and doubt about the safety of your loved ones? Number 8, if you were a villager who was helped by Dr. Ibarra or Pastor Gomez with your physical and spiritual needs, and you knew they were putting themselves under suspicion to help you, how would you feel toward such a person, toward his or her message and the God they serve? Number 9, what does the response of the El Salvadoran Lutheran Church regarding the use of non-seminary trained lay ministers teach us about ministry and about the priesthood of all believers? What implications does this have for our ministry and our churches? Should we wait until an emergency situation makes this necessary here? Why or why not? Number 10, what economic, political, or social factors here in the USA might be contributing in any way to the unrest and upheaval in El Salvador and Central America? Number 11, why do we often have to go through trials and suffering in order to grow spiritually? What does Gomez's story say to us in this regard? Have we ever been through a similar circumstance? Why does the church seem to have to suffer in order to learn what it means to be the church? And number 12, in what way has the struggle to minister under difficult circumstances been a blessing for the Lutheran Church in Central America? I think the people there are beginning to learn to depend more upon God than on some lifeline to the USA. That was their big problem before. It's interesting that the church is finally beginning to grow, too, both internally and in numbers as a result of all of this. That's a very interesting phenomenon. lay training has become a reality instead of something they just talk about. Lay involvement has become a reality also. Okay, which question are you relating to? About the publicity regarding, you want to talk about that one? My own feeling is that the reason this was not spoken about and why even President Bowman wouldn't deny this actually happened probably if he had to say something publicly, it's because the pressure was put upon him right away not to embarrass the El Salvadoran government, especially right before the elections. Okay. And it would have been embarrassing if it had come out that they had connections with the death squad. Because even though it can't be proved conclusively, it seems very possible to me that the death squads were at least under some control of the government. Because how could they have kept them from killing these men when they normally did that? I mean, I believe that the prayers had an awful lot to do with it too. But that's why I asked the question before, was it a combination? I personally think it was a combination. I think God could use that pressure too to help save these people. But I think it would have been embarrassing for the administration, which was siding with the military government, to have to put them under pressure. They were already getting pressure from the El Salvadoran government not to pressure them on the rights issues. Does that make sense? Now this is theory. I can't prove all this, but I believe this is very feasible.
I would like to get to question number 9.
Okay, let's see if we can find that one. What is the response of the El Salvadoran Lutheran Church regarding the use of non-seminary trained lay ministers teach us about ministry and the priesthood of all believers? What implications does this have for our ministry and churches, etc.? Okay, would you like to respond to that? I really was referring to the church in El Salvador,
yes,
that they became more responsive and responsible as a result of this problem. Well, I wanted to say at some point that I'm not at all in favor of promoting this kind of situation in order for the church to be the church. In other words, I wouldn't be in favor of us finding another place to start a war where a church is kind of weak and going in the wrong direction so we could get that church alive again. I think there ought to be another way to do it by, you know, getting into the Word, by prayer and other things that church people ought to do. What do you think about that? Do you think they became more involved and went out and shared their faith because of intimidation or because of a real conviction? Well, maybe they were intimidated before. Let's put it this way. Maybe there was intimidation. I'm sure there was, and fear. But Pastor Gomez overcoming his fear of death was, as he puts it, as he explains it very well, that was the breaking point for him. And when he was able to live in that freedom, it was so contagious that others could see that. They could see he was a free man. And that no one could own him, no matter what he did. That he could walk around and do his ministry with no fear of what would happen, because he had faced death and he had seen that he could even die if he had to, and it wouldn't be the end. Now, I would like to say this. I believe that the church could have been healthier earlier and sooner in Central America had there been a different relationship with their partner church here in the States. That's a very serious judgment on my part, I know, but since I was a missionary under the same structure, I think I can say that with some authority. I think that we need to have a partnership understanding, a feeling that we're working together, and to give the trust that's needed to these fellow workers, and to allow the national workers to operate with their gifts without expecting that they always would have to come up to certain American standards or whatever we make as standards. If they can minister effectively to their village, to their community, and they have the gifts to do that, they should be encouraged to do that. And if that freedom had been there all along, perhaps it wouldn't have taken this kind of dramatic situation to wake the church up. Does that make sense to you? I think it's a very important factor. Any other question?
I find your comment about the Bachelet's prayer to and after the production alarmingly frank about you sharing about how maybe I heard it wrong. I kind of hope I did, I guess. That kind of beforehand he was going through the motions. Mm-hmm. His heart wasn't in it, is kind of what I heard you say. And afterwards, he realized that he had faced death, and he realized the seriousness of the situation, and he realized with a hole in the ball game, and he, all of a sudden the fervor, he was alive with fervor, and he went back out, and it was contagious, and you know, things mm-hmm. really came around. I guess I find that, a very honest. If a guy can admit that, it's a very honest statement. I mean, he's really opened up, but I guess I'm disturbed if a person in his position, which apparently is a fairly, he's president of the Lutheran Church and so on in the country, a fairly high-powered position, and yet he's just going through the motions. That doesn't give me much confidence in other people in those positions, if in fact there's anything to that.
I think we could. I tell you how it hit me personally. I feel like I'm committed, certainly, to my ministry. But when I heard this story from a very close friend who works with Pastor Gomez on a regular basis, and who's worked with him for years, and who helped train him, even, you know, I believed what he said. And I've worked with national workers before, and I've felt this concern. You know, you just wonder how much the commitment is there. If you left and you didn't send the salary anymore, the subsidy, would there be the loyalty? Would the church continue? You never know until you leave and try it, but that was my concern. But then I asked myself, how committed am I really in my ministry? Would I be able to minister with enthusiasm under the same circumstances? It's one thing if you have a congregation that pays your salary every 15 days and, you know, things are moving along fairly normally. But what if you were living under those circumstances where you didn't know if you were going to get paid, where you didn't know if you were going to be alive even? That would make a difference, I think.
Yeah, just sort of a candid response to your reaction. On a much simpler and easier base to understand, my experience with anyone who has faced death or approached death and then recovered or gone on to live, it is very understandable that there's a new vitality, a new view of life, whether they're old, young, clergy, non-clergy, leaders, non-leaders. I remember an appliance salesman in a small town who was physically dead and had this experience of dying and coming back. Mm-hmm. And his testimony of how every moment was a gift and the world was bright and the colors were bright and everything was new. And so I guess to hold any leadership in judgment who would make this type of confession, I would expect very much, even my very, very, very best months or weeks when I'm most enthusiastic about the gospel, if I were to pass through this experience, I would come back 50 times as vital. I just don't think that's something to be shocked by or alarmed.
Do you expect your missionaries and national workers to be super dedicated? I guess that's an interesting way to look at it. I guess we do, but if you've ever been one, you realize how frail we really are. Does that help?
Well, yeah, I find it a very honest statement, but it was disturbing at the same time. I can understand what you're doing.
But I would say we American missionaries and our structure itself is very much responsible for any of that kind of tendency that we would find in any of our national people. I really would. I think that's where the weight of judgment would have to be placed rather than on the person, because we have made them into that kind of subservient, dependent, I can't even think of all the words I would use, but I feel so strongly about it, I would say that we have the responsibility, and that needs to be faced.
I was just going to say that sometimes when you're doing a job, and it wouldn't necessarily have to be in the ministry, you really feel like you're doing the best job that you can do at that time, and that you're really doing a good job. Then something comes along that really shakes up your life, some sort of a crisis. And I don't know if it would necessarily have to be death, but it would have to be something, you know, serious. And you move on to a new level of growth that you never knew was possible before. And then looking back, you don't think that you did such a good job before. But I don't think the person would have, at the former time, been able to see that. Because they didn't know that there was another level of growth.
That's right.
Where you could get to until you pass through this other thing. And then you can look back and say, my priorities were not right before or whatever.
Okay.
Sometimes I think we tie the hands of our missionaries because they're right there. They see where the needs are, and we have set up rules to govern what they can do and what they cannot do, and so they are unable to move, and probably takes something like this before they go ahead and do it anyway, if you know what I mean.
That's exactly right. I think if we go back and study examples of missions that have flourished during particular times in history, we can see this very... I would like to see someone do a study on this sometimes. I believe you could show there is a relationship.
I would like people, more and more Christians, talking about what happens. And not basing it on what intimidation they have been through. Not saying, I'm more of a Christian today than I was yesterday because I've been intimidated or anything.
What in your experience and your background would lead you to feel this way? Can I respond to what I think I hear you saying, and you tell me if this is not on the right track, but is it possible that sometimes people in South Africa say, well, you know, this is a bad situation we're in here, but it's making us stronger Christians, so let's not be totally upset about it. That would not be a proper attitude, would it, to say we accept the situation of inequality and injustice because it's making us stronger Christians. Is this what you're saying in part?
I guess that's basically the reason, because our church, the Dutch Reformed Church in Africa, basically preaches predestination. And a lot of things happen to my people. And
you don't think that was predestined, do you?
I don't believe so. Because people just resign, you know, anything bad happens to them. And they say, well, it's the will of God. It wouldn't have happened if God hadn't wanted it.
How many of you understand where he's coming from? I think that's a very valid point, and it's it's good that you shared it. And probably no one here but you could have shared it that way. That's real helpful. Did you have some?
Yes. I was just thinking this morning, Dr. Witt's comment in regards to training the lay people to go on out, shall we say, with the message. I would have thought by now we would have learned our lesson. I stop and think of India, for an example. We no longer can take our white missionaries in there if we would have trained them. But always we have a structure. They've got to have all of this training. And last September I was here and listened to two retired pastors that came back from China. And I listened to them as they said, all we have is a layer, shall we say, of lay people who have 2 years. All we need is materials to go ahead and continue feeding, shall we say, the flock. And as I listen to the deaconess and I see one of the diaconate back here, it seems to me that when we had a shortage of pastors, they were in demand. But it seems to me there are so many places where we can use them today that because there isn't that no longer that demand, we sort of say, hey, we'll shun you off for the time being. It looks to me like we ought to take more time training our lay people for another layer, which is down below, instead of the layer up here on top, adding up here. That's why I seem to hear you saying that we need to train a paraprofessional type of pastor who may have 1 or 2 years to begin with, mm-hmm. but underneath the supervision of somebody who's sending them all out. So that we can get that message out there a lot sooner and a lot quicker. And I think a lot of us, shall we say, could be trained in that manner.
I know my own background in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, we have a very classical kind of training program. And personally, I think we spent so much time learning Hebrew and Greek that we didn't have very much time left over to really get into the scripture itself. I felt very concerned about that over the years. Another example for me that bears out what you're saying is a fellow that we had in one of our little missions in Venezuela, in a place called Quebrada Seca, which means dry gulch, by the way. And dry gulch was pretty dry and a pretty difficult place to work. It wasn't for that reason, though, that we didn't send an Anglo to work there. It was just that we were able to see in that situation that God had raised up a particular individual. He had only 6 grades of education, but he had spiritual gifts, and he had an eagerness to learn. He was at least 2 or 3 steps ahead of his other fellow Christians in that community, and was a leader, a born leader. And we essentially called him to be the pastor of that community. And this man, with his natural leadership ability, was able to serve that community very well, very effectively, and was continually trained so that he could become more effective. I think the mistake would have been to take this man, not necessarily a mistake, but it could have been a mistake, would be to take this man and send him to, let's say, Chicago and, you know, teach him in a more formal setting. Would he ever be able to go back to that village? That would be the question, and be effective. I would doubt it myself. So there are real needs to let people be the church wherever they are, and to have those different levels, as you say, of ministers. That would be good. But what if you were a villager who was helped by Dr. Ivada or Pastor Gomez with your physical and spiritual needs, and you knew they were putting themselves under suspicion to help you? How would you feel toward people, toward their message and the God they serve? I remember one of the stories that Gary McClure told me when he had just talked to Pastor Gomez. He said they, every night after their prayers, go to bed almost weeping, thinking of the opportunities they have to turn down. People will come to this refugee center, and little groups of campesinos, and they're very humble people. They'll take their sombreros, and they're real nervous to stand in front of you, and they'll kind of twist their sombreros around and nervously ask, could you come to our village and teach our people? And he says there's so many that they can't do this anymore. And so it's a real challenge to that church and to us too, to do what we can to see that these people are fed. They're asking for it. Now again, you know, we're not saying that we should promote war so that people are more hungry for the word, but it's an interesting phenomenon that, at least in my experience, we never had in Venezuela people coming to us and saying, will you come to my village and teach us the word? That just didn't happen. It really didn't. Isn't that true? So, you know, you think to yourself, well, God can still use this to help the church, but we have to do it now while there is that hunger, because maybe God will permit this thing to be solved soon, and there won't be the chance and the openness on the part of people later on. Other questions while we still have a little time?
What about your question about what can Christians do? Or what can we do? I think you had a question in there.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think that had to do more with our structure and our American United States. Let's go to that question. That's probably a very good one. What role have we played in bringing about the situation in Central America? Now, I've talked about this with groups of Christians and American Christians before, and I always find a great amount of hostility. I must say that right away. So if you're willing to be challenged a moment, I think that we do have some real responsibilities here. Economically, we certainly do, because over the years you can document the fact that our administrations over the years, not just Republicans, but Democrats all the way down the line, have sided with the landed and the wealthy, and that together with those people in the other countries, let's take El Salvador, Central America, we have almost always sided with those regimes, and usually they're military regimes that protect our interest. If you take Central America, and you study the geography and the economic situation, you find that the best arable land, and by the way, not all the land is that good. You look at all the green trees and you say, wow, this must be good land to grow things on, but that's not true. It's a very small percentage. Mexico, for example, has only about 17% of its land that is capable of growing anything. See, that puts pressure on a country with that kind of population, doesn't it? Now, if you take El Salvador or Honduras, would be a better example, I guess, with the tremendous amount of emphasis on growing bananas. Where do those bananas go? Now, I love bananas. I want to let you know that right away. I do. I like, when I'm home, I eat one banana every day at least. And I'm not sure if I'm ready to give up bananas. But it really does raise a question in my mind that the best land is being used to grow a food that I could live without. I've lived for a week now without bananas. And we could find substitutes or something, couldn't we? But that is protecting. Now I know right away somebody's going to say, well, what do you substitute for bananas in that country? Because isn't that the economy? What would you replace it with? Isn't this so? But you see what kind of economy we have helped produce, a dependent economy, just like the dependent church I described earlier. And so when they need to develop in a different direction, they can't, because we have forced them into a certain mold that they have to follow. Do you see what I'm saying? Now that challenges people, and I know there's a lot of holes you could shoot in what I'm saying, but if essentially a simplistic answer to the question is what I've just said. And I think we are challenged to say, are we ready to challenge that whole structure that's bigger than all of us? And where do you start? I don't know.
Don't forget to add that land could be used to feed those people who are hungry.
That's the point. Exactly. And then don't forget, in Honduras, as I pointed out before, there are at least 100,000, the latest figures show, campesinos who do not have land and who are begging for land. And this is the pressure that is being placed on that country now. And this is the real reason why we have problems in Central America. Will Honduras be the next country? It already is right on the border with El Salvador, right? That's why El Salvador and Nicaragua and all the other ones got into the situation they're in. It's not a military threat necessarily, it's an economic problem. But unless we get to the root of the justice situation, will it ever go away? And to get to the root of it, we have to get to ourselves. That's what I'm trying to say. I hope that hasn't been too hard for you to swallow, but it has to be said.
Coffee's no different, is it? Isn't coffee similar?
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. One crop economies are the typical situation in South America. And when a country tries to break out of that, they find themselves trapped. They find no way out of it. It's like a maze that you can't get through because there's, and I must say, to be all in complete fairness, we need not take all the blame, because it takes two to tango, as they say. And the others who are involved are the very wealthy 5% in those countries who are in league with this and who realize that they can't continue to have the power if the situation changes. So they're for the status quo. And we're for the status quo because that's easier to deal with. It's anything like revolution sounds frightening to us, right? And besides, it will affect our prices in our grocery stores and so forth and so on. But I want to finish with a question just to make you think a little bit. I find it very interesting that in our country, which started with a revolution, that we have become so judgmental toward our sisters and brothers in Central America who are looking for the exact same justice and peace that we were looking for, our forefathers were, when we broke away from England. And we have such short memories. That was a revolution. We call it the Revolutionary War. And yet we reject wholeheartedly and completely, almost inevitably, the idea of a revolution. I think we as Christians reject it in part because of our concern for nonviolence, and that's probably true. But how do we justify what our forefathers did? We do that, don't we?
We celebrate it every year.
We celebrate it. We do. We shoot off the bombs and everything else. I think it's an interesting question to chew on for supper since we ran out of time. But let me just finish with this concluding comment. I think it's interesting, no, not just interesting, significant, to note that through suffering, for the sake of the gospel, Lutherans and the Lutheran Church in El Salvador have discovered what real faith and hope are all about. And I believe their struggle to minister under difficult circumstances has been a hidden blessing for them and for us. As this brother has said, I think though we should not promote violent situations in order that the church grow. That's not what we're saying. But if it has happened, or justified, that's not what we're trying to conclude. But the fact is, it has been a healthy thing. There has been a purifying, as the word I read earlier from 1 Peter points out. Purifying effect has taken place because people have been under pressure. I guess a holy pressure has been applied there in a certain sense. So it's kind of neat, isn't it, that the name of the refugee center kind of speaks a sermon in itself to us and a message to us that we should remember faith and hope in the midst of suffering. I hope you can take something of that home with you.
Could you just add a little bit? You talked about their growth and purifying. Where is it going to take them to? What is their future?
I guess, like us, we have to see where God's going to lead us next. What new adventure will He have in store for us tomorrow or the next day? I don't know. But I would hope it would be a self-propagating, a self-governing, and certainly, you know, a church that's in charge of its own destiny under the guidance of the Holy Spirit. Not under our guidance, but as a partner with us, teaching us as much as us sharing and teaching them.
Okay.
Oh, is that right? Do you want to talk a little longer? You can, or if you want to leave.
I just want to ask you something about, you know, the economic situation. Now, a few people that are getting wealthy are holding most of the land, and it's profitable for them to grow things like bananas because we in the United States will pay for the bananas.
Regular.
What can ever change? I mean, how can that ever change so that they would want to share their land or grow food for their own people? Mm-hmm. You know, how would that ever?
Well, it is a complicated matter, as I said, because you've got a certain amount of jobs are guaranteed, and this argument would be used by these people. See, we're giving jobs to so many people to cut the bananas, load them on the trains, and on the dock at the boats and so forth and so on. What would they do if they didn't have these jobs? But I think it would be better, even though there would be a very difficult transition period, to go in a gradual way maybe toward another economic base. Perhaps it would not mean giving up bananas altogether, but making bananas less important for your economy. And that country has to make that decision, and I'm not sure any of them are ready to do that.
Have they not been growing bananas and coffee down there for how long? 100
yes.
years?
I read recently, and I can't quote the source, but I did read that in the last 50 years we have sent the Marines into Central America as many as 35 times. I don't know when all those times were. That goes back to the 1800s. But, you know, we say we did, you know. I was shocked when I read that. I would like to read more about it and be able to really document that. But it, even four or five times seems too many. When you consider that we want to determine our future, we want to determine what we are as a nation, why does America always decide what is best for these countries. This is what we're doing. And yet we become unglued when we think about Cuba or some other powers having something to say about their destiny. I think we're kind of hypocritical myself, and I'm certainly not in favor of Cuba. I think the Nicaraguans, for example, have made a little bit of a strategic, not just a little bit, but a very serious strategic error in aligning themselves so closely with Cuba. Because I think at one time they had an option of getting greater support for their movement had they not linked themselves so closely with that particular regime. They put themselves under great suspicion at that point. But nevertheless, you should not totally write off Nicaragua because of that connection, because we have some very serious mistakes and involvements too.
Well, that's just what I was going to say. You know, I mean, those countries have been that way for hundreds of years, and the U.S. Comes in and heavens, I'm not a politician at all, and I don't agree with some of the things that our country does, and I'm sure that maybe a lot of you other people are the same way. And we don't know who they're backing, and if that's the right group to back besides. And it's very, very a big problem now, because if the U.S. doesn't get in there and do something, perhaps it will all be communistic controlled countries.
Well, if that's our concern, I would say this. Even if we're not operating as a country out of Christian concerns, why can't we operate out of self-interest? And if we're really concerned about self-interest, we ought to get to the root of the problem finally, instead of, you know, digging in the same soil and creating the same problem over and over again. We're only going to be asking another 20 years down the road for another series of the same kinds of revolutions if we're able to put the lid on this situation by sheer force and, you know, military power. I think it's going to still be there, because the basic problem is injustice, the lack of sharing of resources, the fact that 5% of the people have 90% of the wealth. You just can't, when people become more educated, when they know that through just looking at television, even if they've never gone to school, they can see what the rest of the world has, their expectations begin to rise. This is a movement that's occurring throughout the world, and you can't control that. It's happening.
Yes.
Well, are we going to put this off forever? I don't think we can.
Yeah. I agree.
Couldn't agree more there. You know, like in South Africa, there's a parallel that's happening right now. You say you should get to the root of the problem, and that's the way I feel should be. You should be doing. But what's happening now is the present administration specifically has decided to engage, they call it constructive engagement. And what they keep giving military assistance to South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And
they're giving approval at the same time, aren't they?
Yes. And this doesn't help things, because it just creates more pressure on us and creates more explosiveness. Our government doesn't help us with those weapons. Instead, it uses them to suppress it. And this government doesn't help our situation, because our government will not be willing to talk with us as long as they are powerful. But should you take out the military assistance, then possibly they might be willing to talk.
Well said.
We are
learning
from Vietnam, didn't
we? Same thing.
Is Duarte a puppet of the CIA?
Oh, I don't. I don't know too much about the CIA, so I can't.
Well, of the United States government. I mean,
I don't think he was our most favored candidate, but I think he was acceptable. But we basically got who we wanted.
Yeah.
It was between two people, and we got.
Was it
one
legit?
That we can still work with, so to speak.
You think it was an honest election? Or did we tilt it?
Yeah, probably so. I guess this is the part that grieves you, because you know the campesino, the poor farmer type person who stands in the line for 24 hours or how long it is. If you've ever known any of these people, which we have, we've worked with them, you can just understand why they would do this. There's that incredible hope that this would be different, that this time around it will change. They're incredible people that way. I don't know if we could have that patience and that kind of hope that it would really work this time. You know, we've been through, I don't know how many elections in Venezuela, and as an outsider, you'd look at these parties and you'd hear the slogans and the promises, and you'd say to yourself, it doesn't matter who you vote for, folks, it's all going to be the same anyway. And they would go to the polls and be real excited about it because they really thought that this would work. You know, there's that real, almost naive hope. I guess that's all you have when you don't have anything else, right?
Isn't that what we're getting to do next?
But I would hope myself that their hope as Christians could be placed in something more real, as you know. And if, I guess you kind of wonder sometimes, are you helping people by bringing up all of these doubts? But because you're going to make more frustration, you know what I'm saying? The more you share what you see happening with fellow Christians in these countries, and they begin to see what's happening to themselves, that resignation that's been there begins to disappear a little bit, and there's a growing frustration. Finally, that just explodes. And so as a Christian, you say, have I contributed to this? And yet, if you don't contribute to it, are you being honest? It's a very interesting question. Okay.
I was going to say, actually, it was yesterday you talked about this, and the editorial section especially points out the fact that the Mexican government right now is asking the United States for an apology because Jack Anderson and Associates had found that Madrid has squared away $1.6 million, which is sort of unusual. And I didn't realize that he was a finance minister when Lopez was the president, who had squirreled away something like $3.6 million.
That's
Curtis, and he came in underneath the platform, I'm going to clean everything up. So suddenly, while we have been here at Poland this week, all of this has occurred on the outside. So if you want to read all the rest of the details, it's in the Wenatchee News on June the 7th, okay?
Well, there's a good example. We live in El Paso, and of course, what is a million people across the river there is our nearest neighbor, and the fervor and the excitement when they were electing this man was incredible. You know, they really believed that this was going to change everything, despite the fact that he was from the same party. You know, you could just say to yourself, oh, here we go again, you know, the same old thing. Anyway, even if he were completely honest, in my opinion, the structure is so rotten underneath him that it would take, I guess, God himself to straighten that matter out. Really, it's incredible. The mordidas, you know, the levels of dishonesty in the Mexican government particularly. I don't mean this to be an ethnic or natural, you know, criticism of that whole nation. I'm just saying the people don't deserve those kinds of leaders that they have, unfortunately. And the power there is so concentrated and so well manipulated that you wonder, too, what that's going to lead to.
Well, when the peso was devalued several times in the last couple of years, if the United States had not refinanced the loans on Mexico, we would have had a stock market crash here in the United States, because they owe us that much money that we had to refinance those loans. And they owe us incredible, incredible amounts of money. I can't even see numbers that big.
It's become a catch-22 situation.
Yeah.
You know, you support a government, because if you don't, you're going to go down too.
Yeah.
It's just incredible.
Once you get into it, you're into it.
Yeah.
There's no getting out. Mm-hmm.
So you have to make it work, even though you know really deep down inside that it won't work. We're going to have to count the cost eventually. I don't know where it's all going to, but Central America and Mexico, our nearest neighbors, for one thing, we need to give more attention to that area of the world. It's unfortunate that it's taken this kind of a problem to even get any kind of attention on TV or anywhere else. But the problem's been there all along, and it's real hypocritical of one administration to blame the other, because these problems haven't just occurred overnight. Each administration has added its own part of the blame, you know, by continuing policies that stress military aid rather than other kinds of concerns. I don't know why myself we can't tie some strings to our aid. If we're going to use money, we ought to use it in a wise way, in my own opinion. You know what I'm trying to say? If we're going to use money to accomplish certain ends, then we should say, for example, you get this aid if this occurs, even though it is force and even though it isn't. It's a contradiction to what I said earlier about letting them determine their own future, but knowing the truth that we aren't going to get out of this situation and that we are going to continue as a nation to be involved, I guess realistically I'm saying let's do it in a way that will help bring about some positive changes, not continuing the status quo.
I agree 100%, but haven't they tried to do that? And then, you know, the Civil Rights or the Rights Commission says that the death squad activity has kind of died away, then they're going to get the aid, and report comes in, it hasn't died away, but Reagan goes ahead and signs it anyway. And
listen, 15 years ago, when I was the director of the Spanish Lutheran Hour, I used to meet regularly with my counterpart in Guatemala, Felipe Alvarez, who's still director of the Central American Lutheran Hour. And Felipe and I used to be roommates. I couldn't sleep when I would room with him, not because he snored, but because he told these incredible stories, and he just kind of liked to shake me up, I guess. But he used to tell me these incredible stories 15 years ago, long before this present crisis occurred, about the death squad in Guatemala, and those still exist too. And it was the same story that I'm telling you about Gomez and Ibarra, same story. You know, pick them up after a meeting, throw them in the car and kill them and dump them out on the side of the road. This has been going on for years. So, you know, what does this all say?
Isn't Venezuela where all the mothers have the watch? Isn't that the country that all the children have, so many, many people have disappeared?
Not so much in Venezuela. Venezuela is perhaps, I would say, the most democratic of all the Latin American countries. There are only three right now, really, true democracies. Well, not sure we can even say that, but democracies in quotes, Venezuela, Colombia, Costa Rica would be your only real democracies at this point. Everything else is a military dictatorship. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? Not very comforting, really. Thank you.
Thank you.